Okay, here we go. Blood cultures. And this is fun. Now, wasn't last week a fun week? Wasn't last week a fun week?
Yes.
And we're still smiling. Okay, this week's a fun week, too. Every week's a fun week. Okay, we have two definitions that we have to understand here, bacteremia and septicemia. Okay, bacteremia, the word just means bacteria in the blood. Whereas septicemia means bacteria in the blood with symptoms. So we've got some systemic symptoms. Now, either of these can be transient, intermittent, or continuous. Transient just means the organisms appear there briefly, and then usually the phagocytic cells in the body, the immune system, is sufficient enough to rid the body of those organisms. So that's why with bacteremia we don't have symptoms. But with septicemia it becomes a little bit more severe. Intermittent means that there's probably some abscess in the body, some focus of infection that is releasing organisms into the blood intermittently. So sometimes they're there, they go away, they might appear again. That's what we mean by intermittent. Continuous means they're constantly there. And mostly, this applies to septicemia when we get symptoms associated with it. Serious symptoms, fever, chills, what's tachycardia?
Rapid
heartbeat, hypertension, low blood pressure, patient might go into shock, or other symptoms as well. But this can be a very serious condition. So it's important when we get rapid, or when we get blood cultures, that we are able to rapidly identify the organisms, especially if the patient has septicemia. Now, sometimes transiently, we've probably all had this, organisms can appear in the blood just from simply brushing your teeth. If you brush vigorously, you might get a little tear or something in the gingival tissue that allows those organisms that are in the oral cavity, because we've got a lot of them in there, to get into the blood transiently. So that could be one means. Or just going to the dentist, dental procedures. And sometimes the patient, the dentist, we've got a couple potential dentists in here. Peter, Quinn, you guys are dental. Anybody else? Rich? No? Okay. Anyway, this is one thing that the dentist needs to be aware of. If the patient has a history of heart problems or heart valve problems or something like that, the dentist should prescribe some antibiotics prior to the patient coming in for the dental work. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we get into the disease state. Okay. Why would the doc request blood cultures? Well, if the patient suddenly spikes a fever, or even hypothermia, leukocytosis, elevated white count. Yep.
Since I'm not intelligent when it comes to Celsius, can you translate those?
37 degrees is what? 98, about normal. Yeah, so it's just slightly above.
Just slightly
elevated. Right.
Okay.
Celsius is what? Fahrenheit plus 9/5 plus 32? Or times 9/5 plus 32. There's a formula there that we can easily convert. Okay, or sudden onset of chills, hypertension, delirium, some of these things, just suddenly, and there's no particular reason that the doc knows of for these, request the blood culture. Also, we've talked about that sometimes with urine cultures, the doc will also send a blood culture along with it, or spinal fluids will get a blood culture. Or maybe in cases where there's pneumonia, they will send a blood culture along with the sputum sample, because sometimes we can identify the organism in the blood and can't identify it in the sputum. So there are a number of reasons for getting a blood culture in the laboratory. Okay, antecedent events. These are events that might precede organisms in the blood or lead to having organisms in the blood. Burns, trauma, some underlying disease, patients on immunosuppressant drugs, prior antibiotic use. I mean, that can slow us down in terms of identifying the organism. We'll talk a little bit more about that. Age, which usually refers to either the very young or the very old. invasive procedures like, what did we say never to do last week? Never to have done.
Catheter.
Right, catheter. So some invasive procedures like that can lead to organisms in the blood infections. But so those are some of the antecedent events, but not all of them. Okay, what type of organisms are we looking for in blood cultures? Well, this was a study that was done at one hospital, so this doesn't translate to everything, but it's fairly common across the board, the types of organisms we see. Look at that list. There's a whole bunch of them on there. Plus, we've got another page. Oops. Well, we'll go to the other page here in a minute. What's at the top of the list?
E. coli.
E. coli. Okay, so that's a very common organism that causes septicemia. Now notice there's a lot of staph, strips, Klebsiella, Pseudomonas bacteroides. What's bacteroides? Anybody know that? It's an anaerobe, right. Okay, let's put a, just draw a line right here. Let's not worry about everything, but the most common ones here. So there are a lot of Enterobacteriaceae, other Enterobacteriaceae, in addition to Klebsiella, E. coli. What is Pseudomonas? What class of organism? Non-fermenter. How do we initially differentiate Pseudomonas from E. coli? What test?
Oxidase.
Oxidase, right. Oxidase positive. What does Pseudomonas do on TSI? You call that one? Got a $100 bill in my pocket for anybody.
Yeah,
okay.
Over.
Time's expired. Sorry. K over no change, yeah, because it's a non-fermenter. So K over no change. So if we were to do TSIs on these, which we would do, then we'd come up with no oxidase positive TSI that's K over no change. That's a good clue we're dealing with Pseudomonas, so don't forget about Pseudomonas in there. Okay, now notice also over here is a list of contaminants. Okay, what's the most common contaminant? Staph epidermidis. Now, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because that's all over the skin. So we have to scrupulously cleanse the skin before we take our blood cultures. We're going to go through that process. But look what else is happening here. Not only is it a common contaminant, but there are cases where it is a cause, a true pathogen. So how do you know? If you isolate staph epidermidis or nothing else, how do you know if it's a contaminant or if it is a pathogen?
Multiple samples.
Multiple samples. That's a good clue, right? So this becomes very problematic if we've got staph epi in there and can't find anything else. Is it really a pathogen or is it just a contaminant? So it becomes very important to cleanse the skin so that we don't get that as a contaminant. And we'll do multiple cultures. We'll talk about that. Okay, so just don't automatically discard staph epi as a common contaminant. Okay, here's the list continues. Again, we don't need to know all of these, but notice that even some yeast can be in there. There's Listeria, more anaerobes in there. Haemophilus is way down the list, and usually you don't see Neisseria in there unless the patient has a sexually transmitted disease.
What about Salmonella? Because when we discussed that, we talked about that. I actually had Salmonella bacteremia when I was a kid.
Salmonella what?
A Salmonella bacteremia.
Did you when you were a kid? Okay. Over here where it says other Enterobacteriaceae, Salmonella can fit into there. Okay. Not real common, but it's possible. Particularly if a patient has typhoid fever. I'm sure you didn't have typhoid fever because we don't see that much anymore. But it would appear first in the blood before it appears in the stool sample for typhoid fever. So it's a possibility. But with Neisseria, again, we're not going to see much of it unless it's a sexually transmitted disease, and then it's very rare. So we're not automatically looking for Neisseria and Haemophilus. Just so you have to get in your mind, again, what are the most likely organisms that we're going to see? Okay, how do they get in there? Portals of entry. 25% of them from the genitourinary tract. This would be maybe through surgical procedures or maybe through just a physical exam of some sort, or again, if it's the urinary tract, catheters, or pyelonephritis. Okay, so what's pyelonephritis again? Pyelonephritis?
Kidney infection.
Kidney infection, right. More severe than cystitis. What's cystitis?
Bladder
infection.
Yeah.
Okay, so with pyelonephritis, it can get in the kidney, and from the kidney, it can get into the blood and travel that way. Okay, respiratory infections, particularly pneumonia, can cause problems. Abscesses somewhere in the body where we've got an infection that there are organisms there that are being released from that abscess. Again, this would be more of an intermittent type release. Surgical wound infections, this is probably more likely a nosocomial infection. Biliary tract, miscellaneous sites, and here, again, 25%, as much as genital urinary, on certain sites. So we don't always know where it's coming from. And that's one of the diagnostic problems that the doc faces, is where is it coming from. Okay, procedure for blood culture. Collection. Sometimes you're going to be the people that collect it. Sometimes it's going to be the phlebotomy team. Sometimes it'll be the nursing staff. Just depends on which hospital you work at and what their protocol is. Nevertheless, we need to make sure that we understand the procedure and convey that to whoever is collecting the sample. First of all, you cleanse the area. We're usually just going to draw the blood here, same place we usually do. Cleanse it with alcohol first, and then cleanse it with a 1 to 2% tincture of iodine. Okay, what is tincture?
It's something dissolved in alcohol.
Right. It's an alcohol base instead of a aqueous base. So, tincture of iodine. And the iodine is going to be much more stringent in cleansing the area than is alcohol. Alcohol oftentimes just washes off the surface, dirt or whatever. It doesn't really kill the organisms. We do it in a circular motion. So you start out at the beginning point, and then you go in concentric circles and just get wider and wider and bigger until you cover that whole area, okay, making sure that you cover it well. And then leave it on there for 1 to 2 minutes. Let it dry for 1 to 2 minutes and work its magic in killing the organisms. And then, again, depending upon the protocol, some places will remove the iodine first before inserting the needle. Some will leave it on and remove the iodine afterwards. You don't really want to leave the iodine on forever because it can be very irritating to the skin. But in this case, it says remove the iodine first with alcohol. After it's dried, remove it. You make sure you always cleanse your finger, gloved finger, if you're going to be palpating the vein afterwards. The rule of thumb is that less than 3% of the cultures should have contamination. It's not possible to get 100% of the cultures that don't have contamination. But you don't want any more than 3%. And they will monitor these. So if we start showing up with more than 3% of our cultures being contaminated with staph, epi, or some other common skin contaminant, then the lab needs to review the collection procedure, re-instruct the phlebotomy team, the nursing staff, whoever is drawing it, and make sure we get that contamination rate down to less than 3%. If we have more than three organisms in the blood, that's in contamination. What is the blood sterile? Yes. Blood is sterile, so there really shouldn't be anything in there if there is no pathogen. And so you can see the importance of cleansing the skin appropriately to reduce the chances of getting staph epi in there as a contaminant. You may draw the blood from three different sites, and that would help determine if we have a contaminant or if the organism is a true pathogen. So you can draw it from one arm, draw it from another arm, draw it from the leg or the hand or some other place. That's one way of determining if it's a pathogen. Okay.
So if you do more than one tube, would that also reduce the chances of a contaminant?
Right. Okay, here we go. How we draw them. The number and timing of the blood cultures. Okay, optimally, we're going to draw three sets of cultures. Okay, a set is two bottles. We incubate one aerobically and one anaerobically. Because as we saw from our list, it is possible to have anaerobes in there that are pathogens. So a set, then, is two bottles. So three sets is how many bottles?
Six.
Six bottles, okay. Within a 24-hour period. So you don't want to just draw one right after another, unless it's down here. We'll talk about this. But usually over a 24-hour period, the lab should receive three sets of blood cultures. Now, to incubate it aerobically, usually what they will do is, if this has got a rubber cap on it, You can just stick a sterile needle in there that's open on the end to the outside, and that allows enough air in there to incubate it aerobically. Okay, the reason we do three sets is because they have found during doing many studies that if we just draw one set, we're only going to have 80% of the bottles positive. If they're a pathogen, we're only 80% of the time we're going to identify the pathogen. And the reason is because sometimes these are intermittent. As we've mentioned, they're intermittent. So we draw a blood sample during the time when the organisms aren't present, we're obviously going to get negative. If we do two sets, we increase our chances up to 90%, but with three sets, we increase our chances to 99% of finding the pathogen. So that's why we do three of them. Because if it's intermittent and we draw one set, we might miss it. It might be negative. But the second set or the third set, we're likely to hit that period of time when the organisms are present in the blood.
Does it matter how far apart you draw the sets?
Just three times within that 24-hour period. Now, each laboratory might have their own specific criteria or protocol how they do it. But just generally, three sets within 24 hours. Okay, everybody got that? Need to know. All right. Now, if the patient comes in and they obviously have an acute febrile illness, the doc's not going to wait 24 hours to draw these cultures. So the rule here is to draw two or three separate samples from separate sites immediately. So draw one from one arm, one from the other arm, one from the hand or the leg or somewhere else immediately, and then send those to the lab. And then the doc can start initiating some antibiotics therapy while waiting for the results from the laboratory. Okay, the volume of blood that we usually draw from an adult is between 10 to 30 milliliters. Usually, optimally, it's at least 20 milliliters. Infants and children, they don't have as much blood volume, so we're going to draw somewhere between 1 to 5 milliliters. Okay, then what we do is we put the blood, it's usually drawn in a syringe, and then put into the blood bottle. We'll see a diagram here where sometimes it's drawn directly into the blood bottle. Okay, we want a blood to broth ratio of 1 to 10. So our bottle contains broth, usually about 90 milliliters of broth. Now we then put 10 milliliters of blood into each bottle. That volume of blood seems to be adequate to, again, find the organisms. If we use less blood, we're not as likely to find the organisms in there. Sometimes it's not possible to get that much blood. They do have smaller bottles that have, for children that have 45 milliliters. But you want this 1 to 10 ratio, ideally. So for adults then, we'll put 10 mils of blood into one bottle and 10 mils into the other bottle. For children, ideally 5 mils, but we might not be able to get that much. So try to, again, maintain the same ratio. But children are usually going to have more organisms in their blood than adults. So we don't need to draw as much blood from the children. Plus, they don't have that much blood volume either. Okay, the broth, culture medium, is just a basic nutrient broth. These are three types, tryptocase soy broth, brain heart infusion, Columbia base. So it's a basic nutrient broth in it. And most organisms are going to grow in there. It also contains an anticoagulant. So we've got to have a broth base and an anticoagulant. The anticoagulant of choice is sodium polyanethyl sulfonate, SPS. It seems that other more common anticoagulants are more inhibitory for the growth of the organism, whereas this one is not. It might inhibit some, particularly Neisseria gonorrhea seems to be a little bit more inhibited with this, but this is usually the anticoagulant that's used. Now, why do we have to have an anticoagulant in there? Well, the blood's going to clot. If we just draw it immediately, either into a syringe or directly into the bottle, it's going to start clotting. We don't want little clots because the organisms can get caught up in the clots, and then we won't be able to identify them. So we don't want the blood to clot. That's why we use the anticoagulant. Okay, here's a diagram of one technique, and again, it's not always done this way, but cleansing in a concentric motion with the iodine. This shows drawing the blood directly into a bottle. And the bottle would probably have a measurement on there that tells you when you've drawn 10 milliliters, and then you change bottles and draw it into another one. But most of the time, it's probably drawn into a syringe, and then the syringe, blood in the syringe is entered into the bottle. Okay, what do we do in the lab when we get the blood then? Process it immediately, so we don't want it sitting around. And report the Gram stain. So we do the Gram stain immediately and report that as preliminary report. Not the final report, but the preliminary report. Preferable to a Gram stain, particularly with blood cultures, is the aquatine orange. Okay, what's aquatine orange again?
Fluorescent.
It is more sensitive. So we are likely to see more organisms. Now, with a blood culture, you can imagine that the whole background has got blood cells in it, red blood cells. So it's a little bit more difficult to see organisms, particularly if there aren't that many organisms. With the aquatine orange, you can see them much better. So this is where the aquatine orange is particularly helpful. But again, not all laboratories have this because they have to have a fluorescent scope to do it. The media that we use, typically blood, chocolate, and MAC. Most everything that we're going to identify can grow on those, either aerobically or anaerobically. The blood bottle, broth bottle, we're going to keep that. We're going to keep incubating it, usually for a week. Now, some labs might say 3 days, or again, that might vary a little bit, but generally for a week. And we're going to examine it daily for evidence of growth. This is particularly important if we don't get any growth on our plates. These are some indications of growth in the bottle. Hemolysis, like staphs and streps that can hemolyze red blood cells. Turbidity, which is just the cloudiness, growth of the organisms. Gas production, that's particularly indicative of Enterobacteriaceae. Many of those organisms are gas producers. Visible bacterial colonies on the surface of the blood. The blood is going to settle down to the bottom of the broth. So you're going to have a layer of blood on the bottom and the broth is above it. So you look on the surface of the blood for visible bacterial colonies, or you can look at on the surface of the broth for a filmy layer. We're going to have blood bottles or broth bottles, blood culture bottles, but we don't have blood in them. Okay, we're not really able to get a bunch of blood that we can put in these bottles. So our bottles will not have blood in them. But I want you to keep your bottles and examine them daily for 4 days. We'll examine them Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and just report what you see on those 3 days. Now, what you will have to be careful of is when you take them out of the incubator, you don't want to stir them or mix them up, because then it's not easy to see if there's colonies growing on the surface of the blood. Of course, we don't have blood in there. So just take them out, examine them, record if you see anything. Obviously, we're not going to see any hemolysis because there will not be any blood in there. But we can look for turbidity, gas production, visible bacterial colonies somewhere. So just do that. Just record it. After Thursday, you can discard them. Okay. One way of entering the blood bottle is by inserting a needle and then taking the cap off the needle, tipping the blood bottle upside down, and putting one drop on the plates. What we're going to use is a tuberculin syringe. So we're going to enter the bottle with a tuberculin syringe, pull out some broth, and then we will inoculate our plates, one drop on each plate, and then go back and streak for isolation. So go back through your primary quadrant where the drop is and streak for isolation. And we will also put a drop on the slide to do the Gram stain. Okay. Now, sometimes labs will do, and they don't always do this, but sometimes they do a procedure called blind subculturing. Blind subculturing means that after about 24 hours, you've already inoculated your plates when you first get it. The next day, you just enter the bottle with a syringe or a needle, like it said, pull out some broth, and inoculate some plates again. it may be that you're not getting any growth on the first plates that you inoculated. So if we do it again after 24 hours, after the organism had a chance to grow in the broth, we might get more. So that's what blind cell culturing means. And again, it depends on the protocol for the laboratory as to whether or not you do that.
When you said to we're going to keep our blood for 4 days, do you want us to like keep them at desk?
No, stick them back in the incubator. Keep them in the incubator. Yeah. And then some labs also, particularly if they have a blood culture bottle that has not grown anything, they'll keep it for a week, and then prior to discarding it, they might subculture it again at the end of that time period before discarding it and recording it as negative. It was entirely negative. Just one more shot at seeing if we can grow something out of it. Okay.
Yep. Would there be any point in doing a blind subculturing if you the actual first day you do have growth?
Probably not. If you've got growth on your plants and something there to identify, then you probably don't need to do blind subculturing. Okay. There are times we can get false negatives. So we see organisms. There's evidence of growth in the bottle, but we don't get anything growing on our plates. Okay? What are some reasons? Again, these are things that you need to think about. It could be that the patient is on previous antibiotic therapy prior to drawing the blood culture. We know what antibiotics do. They suppress the growth of the pathogen like they're supposed to, but it makes it more difficult for us to identify it. So in that case, we probably want to hold the plates for 14 days, 2 weeks, instead of a week, because they grow slowly, and we might be able to recover some growth after that period of time. It might be a fungus, which is sometimes going to grow more slowly. There is a strain of strep that is referred to as nutritionally deficient strep, which means that the strain of strep requires vitamin B6, pyridoxophosphate, which is present in the bottle, enabling them to grow in the bottle, but it is not present in culture plates. So that's why we would see evidence of growth in the bottle, but not on the plates in that particular case. It might be obligate intracellular parasites. Could even be a virus or chlamydia, rickettsia, things like that that are not going to grow on culture media, but they will grow in the broth. Okay, so make sure that you're always trying to correlate what you're seeing with what's going on here. Ah, okay, no naps. People are dozing. I think it's daylight saving times. But what happened if I fell asleep up here?
You and Ollie.
You're just hoping, aren't you? Now, daylight saving time messes me up for at least a week, so I'm not going to be much good this week. Let's go on. Okay, let's talk about a disease state here. one of the disease states that we're looking for with positive blood cultures, and certainly not the only one, but a very important one that can be a very serious one, is endocarditis. What does the word endocarditis mean?
Inflammation
of the inside lining of the heart is what it refers to. Mostly it's an infection of the heart valves, mitral valve, aortic valve are the most common heart valves that are involved. Okay, so infection of endocardium, and usually the patient is going to have symptoms of a severe systemic infection, fever, rigors, leukocytosis. We talked about rigors, didn't we?
Yeah.
What are rigors?
Shaking.
Yeah, that shaking, teeth rattling. Teeth, what is it? Bone rattling, teeth chattering, chill, something like that. I had rigors one time. I was attending a CLS convention out of town. And I used it. I frequently get sick when I go to those things. But I got some kind of miserable upper respiratory tract infection. I remember sitting in one of the meetings, and I was just shaking. I couldn't stand it. So I went back to the hotel room and just took a nap. Okay. Oftentimes, again, this involves colonization of the organisms on the mitral or aortic valves. Frequently, they are previously damaged valves from some other infectious process or something, but they don't have to be. It happens with normal valves as well. And sometimes the patient has a prosthetic valve. They've had heart surgery, valve has been replaced with some prosthetic device, which some organisms can also colonize. Okay, the valve dysfunction leads to congestive heart failure, where the heart just weakens and weakens as a pump, and eventually it leads to death. Now I can tell you're all mesmerized by the arrows. I shouldn't do that, should I? I should just make it very bland and boring.
Yes. So after people have like bypass surgeries, do they watch for infections like they do in the lot?
Yes, yes. They'll definitely monitor the patient very carefully for signs of infection. Okay, let's go on. Now, we can divide endocarditis into two categories. Acute endocarditis and subacute bacterial endocarditis. So acute is obviously more severe, and the infection or the symptoms start relatively rapidly, and it usually runs its course in 6 weeks. Everything's happening within 6 weeks or less. But it's often a more severe type of infection. So what we want to do is obtain three cultures doing it during a 1 to 2 hour period before initiation of therapy. So this is when the patient comes in with severe acute febrile illness, and the doc draws those samples immediately and then initiates therapy. Doesn't want to wait 24 hours to initiate therapy. Okay, subacute bacterial endocarditis. Probably 90% of patients have the subacute bacterial endocarditis. Symptoms, it's more of a prolonged, insidious illness. The patient just doesn't feel well, and things go on for a while. They might have a slight fever, and it just lasts. It just goes on and on. In this case, three cultures per day, and usually they'll do that over 2 days. So within the 24-hour period, we'll get three different sets. When I say three cultures, again, that means three sets. Okay, they'll do that over 2 days, and what we're going to see most likely in endocarditis is continuous bacteremia. So if you're drawing that many bottles, the majority of the bottles are going to have growth in them, both aerobic and anaerobic, because many of these organisms, even though they're not strict anaerobes, they're facultative anaerobes, which means they can grow either in air or without. So you're going to see the majority of bottles are going to have growth in them. So continuous bacteremia, that's one thing that sets apart subacute bacterial endocarditis from some other types of intravascular diseases or abscesses somewhere else where the organism is shed intermittently. So if it's shed intermittently, you would not expect the majority of the bottles to be positive. Okay, common agents of endocarditis. Do you remember way back at the beginning of the semester, we talked about strep viridans as causing 50% of subacute bacterial endocarditis? Okay, what is strep viridans? Is that a species name? Strep viridans? Somebody remember? That $100 bill still sitting in my pocket. Okay, you keep it. What are the characteristics of strep viridans? Blood.
Alpha
hemolytic. Strep viridans, alpha hemolytic. Is it normal flora? Maybe. Somewhere it's normal flora. Oral cavity. Remember doing our throat cultures? We saw predominance of alpha strep or alpha hemolysis on the throat cultures. That's typically strep viridans. So it's normal flora in the oral cavity. It can be normal flora elsewhere. But in the blood, it causes 50% of subacute bacterial endocarditis. So that's primarily what we're looking for. Now, what are the first six organisms up there? Staphs and straps, right? First six organisms. Those are the most common ones. And the reason is because staph and strep have the ability to convert sucrose into dextran, which is a very sticky substance that enables it to adhere more readily to a platelet aggregation. Right? And it also causes platelet aggregation. And that then adheres to the heart valve, which leads to damage of the heart valve. So staphs and streps are much more able to do that, to adhere, than are these other organisms. But obviously we do see some organisms are just not as common as the staphs and the streps. So that's what you're going to look for first. Okay, as far as therapy for endocarditis, it needs to be quick. particularly if it's acute endocarditis. Combination therapy they will usually give. This is an example, certainly not the only type of medication, but oops, both legs are in. But because it's staph and strep, they're the most common ones, we're probably going to initiate therapy with something that's going to be most effective against staphs and streps. It oftentimes continues for 2 to 4 weeks. This is what, in subacute bacterial endocarditis, the most common one. They'll probably continue it out further. Surgery is often a common treatment modality, particularly if they know that there's an infected valve. They'll have to go in and remove that valve, get it out of there. That's the way to get rid of the organisms and the focus of infection and replace it with a prosthetic valve. Mortality untreated can be fatal. So that's why I say it's a very serious disease. Untreated cases, even upwards of 15% mortality rate. So it's important to, you can see the importance of blood cultures and what role the laboratory plays in the diagnosis. Yeah.
How early do they usually, or can they usually diagnose it?
Well, if it's acute, they're going to have a lot of symptoms that are going to look suspicious of endocarditis. And they're going to initiate therapy quickly. But the laboratory, we need to get the results out as quickly as possible. And that's why an immediate Gram stain on the blood culture bottles is helpful, particularly if we see the organism. We're not always going to see it, because we still have to have 10 to the fifth organism. That's the sensitivity of the Gram stain.
So are there cases where it can be successfully treated with antibiotics?
Oh, sure. Most of the cases are treated with antibiotics. If they can diagnose it early and get the right antibiotic, yeah. Now, with subacute bacterial endocarditis, it's not as important that they get that therapy initiated immediately. So they can wait and get the lab report before they treat it. But antibiotics will be the mainstay. And then, if it turns out to be more severe or they determine that there's an infected heart valve, and that's the only way to treat it, then we'll have to do that. One other thing about the collection bottles, the order in which you put the blood in the bottles, there's some disagreement, but most resources say to fill the aerobic bottle first and then fill the anaerobic bottle. And that's because if you don't have quite enough blood, it's more important to put the sufficient volume of blood in the aerobic bottle. Because, again, most of the organisms are going to be aerobic or facultative anaerobes, which can grow in the air. So if you don't have quite enough blood, then you can put the remainder in the anaerobic bottle. The other reasoning is that when you draw the blood, there might be a little bit of air, especially if you're drawing it in a tube directly into the bottle. There might be a little air in there. And we want that to go in the aerobic bottle and not the anaerobic bottle. So that's usually the order in which you add the blood to the bottle, is aerobic first and then anaerobic. Okay, let's see. What's next here? Okay, what we're going to do today. We are going to do the protei. Up close and personal look at Proteus mirabilis and Proteus vulgaris. Okay, we've done a little bit with Proteus, but we haven't really studied it carefully. Do you remember one of the unusual, annoying characteristics of Proteus?
Swarming.
Yeah, swarming all over the place. Hopefully we'll see that. We can deal with that. It really does become annoying and difficult to isolate other organisms that might be in there if you've got Proteus swarming all over. Okay, we're going to inoculate a blood, chocolate, MAC, and a TSI for our known organisms. We're not going to do Gram stains because we've done enough Gram stains on Enterobacteriaceae, and they all look alike. We will Gram stain our unknown, however. Okay, so for the unknown, we'll each have a blood culture bottle. And it has a rubber stopper on it. You need to cleanse that carefully with iodine. So wipe it off with iodine. We've got some iodine swabs. You can share those. Everybody doesn't need their own. You can share those. Wipe off the rubber cap. Let it dry. And then we're going to use a tuberculin syringe. Enter the bottle. Make sure the bottle is well mixed when you first get it. Make sure it's well mixed. Okay, then remove. You don't have to remove. We don't need a whole half a mil, 2/10, 3/10, because all we need is 4 drops, really. So you don't need to fill up that much. put one drop on each plate. So one drop on blood, chocolate, Mac, one drop on slime for the gram stain. You don't need the water for the gram stain, and you can spread it around. There's a caveat down there. Do not stick yourself. Okay. So streak for isolation. Follow the appropriate diagrams. This will be starting tomorrow after you... Because any of these organisms we've talked about, staphs, streps, the Enterobacteriaceae, those are all possibilities. So follow the diagrams that you've already used, that you've already done. And then keep your bottles. Put your bottles back in the incubator and observe them each day and record that on your report sheet. Okay, let's do it. Thank you.